My guest today, Phil Giraldi, has been on Takes on the World more times than I can count, and it's because he always has something relevant to say on critical issues of our day. He formerly served in the CIA as case officer and as an Army intelligence officer with 20 years' experience in Europe and the Middle East. He is a contributing editor of the American Conservative and has written frequently for antiwar.com and more recently for the UNS Report, where yesterday he posted an article, Israel's $38 billion scam. He is currently executive director of the Council for the National Interest, an organization of former U.S. elected and foreign service officials who are dedicated to bringing such scams to an end. Welcome once again, Phil Giraldi, to Takes on the World.
Thanks very much, Joe. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, we had a little problem last time, and I'm glad it worked out this time.
Yeah, so am I.
Well, on September 14th, President Obama culminated a year of negotiations with the Israeli government by awarding a $38 billion worth of U.S. arms over the decade beginning in 2018, which represents a $700 million increase over what they have been allotted over the past decade. Writing in the UNS Review, as I mentioned on Monday, you called it Israel's $38 billion scam. Explain to our listeners why you say it's a scam.
Well, because normally when you consider this kind of military assistance, which is what it is, there's a quid pro quo. And the United States, in cases in the past, like with Turkey and other developing countries, would get basic rights, or they would get alliance-type situations for the U.S. to take advantage of in terms of its global security needs. In the case of Israel, there's actually no quid pro quo. Israel gets the money, has traditionally gotten all this money. The U.S. has no basing rights. Its only bases in the Middle East are in Arab countries. The Israelis give absolutely nothing in return for what they get. And going beyond that, they also have been able to use 26% of the money they get every year to develop their own defense industry, which is in competition with the U.S. defense industry. So we actually lose jobs as a result of this.
Well, it's interesting that we have some U.S. senators, maybe now about a half a dozen of them, starting with Lindsey Graham from one of the nation's poorest states, that is complaining that about the 25% should go back to Israel, which means that he's not concerned about jobs in the United States. He's actually concerned with pleasing Israel.
Yeah, that's the scary part of all this. As much as Obama has basically given Israel virtually everything that Netanyahu was asking for, we have senators who basically say that's not enough. And Graham and McCain and Kelly Ayotte and a number of others are saying that Israel should be able to spend the money however it wants. I mean, they're basically saying it should be able to spend 100% of it on their own defense industry. And they're also saying that the Congress should be able to vote more money on top of this for Israel as needed. So it's kind of an open door to the U.S. Treasury.
No, it's extraordinary also that we had Ehud Barak, who's one of America's favorites, writing in the Washington Post, an American paper, and Moshe Yaalon speaking at the AIPAC spawn Washington Institute for Near East Policy, complaining that it wasn't enough. The biggest arms package in history and far and away bigger than anything the United States has given to Israel before, and it's not enough. It's almost as if Israel is doing the U.S. a favor. It's extraordinary the degree, a sense of entitlement on the part of Israel and the willingness of U.S. Congress to play into their hands.
Yeah, I mean, one of the arguments that they were making was that the previous agreement was 10 years ago, and there's been it should be adjusted for inflation. And that was one of the arguments. And, of course, the argument Netanyahu was making, Netanyahu was actually seeking about anywhere from $4 to $5 billion per year. And the argument he was making was that the United States making a peace agreement with Iran, in which Iran will be unable to develop a nuclear weapon, actually hurts Israel's security. A totally ridiculous argument. And yet this is the argument they were making, that coming to a deal, coming to an arrangement with Iran hurts Israel, so the U.S. should be forced to pay for it.
Now, it's interesting. I mentioned before I called you on my introduction that this was not seen as an issue to raise in the debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump on Monday. And I suspect it won't come up in any of the future debates because, in my take on it, the majority of the American people would not be very happy to find out of this massive gift at a time they're being told there isn't enough money for domestic programs.
Yeah, that's right. And the, one of the interesting things is that, you know, an opinion poll conducted by IRMAP basically showed that 81% of the American public that were polled in the survey are opposed to this money. But the reason why this is not coming up on anyone's screen is because there's been no media coverage on it. It was announced when it happened, and then it disappeared. And there's not been a single editorial in any newspaper in the United States saying that this might be a bad idea. And this is the typical reaction to anything that in the media, that anything that has to do with Israel.
I should say, in 1993, I wrote an article for a magazine that called Lies of Our Times, which probably went out of business because of they had me write articles on aid to Israel and the Israel lobby, which was a no-no then, and they lost subscribers. But I did research and found out that the previous 8 years before I did the article, there was not a single article in the U.S. media other than one in the L.A. Times about U.S. aid to Israel. Not a one. It's something that the media has obviously agreed not to report. There were articles about the foreign aid budget, but the biggest part of it was usually left out. And anyone who wants to go, doubts my word, can go to the library and look at the New York Times index and try and find articles about USA to Israel. And this pattern was followed by most of the major media.
Yeah, this is quite typical. We've reached the point, you know, now so many years later, where we can somewhat talk about this kind of stuff, but of course, it's still pretty much concentrated in the alternative media, and any kind of serious criticism of the relationship with Israel is just in the mainstream media non-existent. And there are lots of good reasons why the United States should be very wary of getting too involved with Israel's politics and with its foreign policy.
You know, it's the media is really important on this because even the alternative media doesn't want to take on this issue. There's been a lot of discussions about boycott and divestment and sanctions, and now more than 23 states have passed resolutions, the latest being California, that would make any company that would boycott an Israeli company violate the state law. And the California, ironically, Israel is being protected under a law designed to protect California citizens, which brings the 51st state idea back into reality. But boycott, divestment, and sanctions has really not affected Israel at all. But some of the very same organizations and groups, as you point out, and I pointed out myself in an article on Monday, that did not even mount any kind of campaign, mobilize any kind of campaign to stop this aid package, even though it's been known that it's been in discussion for over a year.
Yeah, that's right. And if you go to the sites of the people who are alleged to be activists, like Jewish Voice for Peace and Code Pink and End the Occupation, they don't talk about it. A couple of them make a cursory comment that they oppose weapon sales to Israel, but it's toothless, and they it's something they don't pursue. It's funny. It's like it's like you have to apologize before you say anything about Israel. These groups feel compelled to prove that they're not anti-Semitic or in any way, and then they kind of drop the argument. They don't pursue it to the point where it's logical to say, yeah, well, if you're against the settlements, then giving Israel $38 billion a year, which is fungible money, I point out in my article, once you got that money in your bank account, which Israel does every year on October 1st, they get the whole year's allotment on the very first day of the fiscal calendar. Once you got that money in your bank account, you have a lot of money freed up to put in settlements and a lot of freed up money to do other things that might not be in America's interest.
Well, another story that never gets reported, but is well known to the funders, is that 88 U.S. senators on September 19th sent a letter to Obama telling him that he should not do anything in the U.N. that would jeopardize Israel's control over the Palestinian territories. And that includes Barbara Boxer, includes Dianne Feinstein here in California, Elizabeth Warren, who almost every other issue is very brave and bold. She's indistinguishable from Lindsey Graham when it comes to Israel.
Yeah, that's right. It's truly, this attitude towards Israel is bipartisan. And the issue for people like us is to kind of figure out where does it come from. And it's easy to say that, well, it's PAC money, political contributions. The Fulbright factor, where if you oppose Israel, you wind up not getting reelected because the media turns on you. So it's a combination of a lot of things. And I would certainly throw into the hopper the fact that groups like AIPAC have virtually the ear of every congressman. The AIPAC has 200 employees, has a budget of $70 million a year, and they're constantly, I was over in Capitol Hill on Monday, they're all over the place, and they're in every congressional office, and they're presenting position papers on why Israel deserves this money, why Israel deserves unlimited political support, and they're in your face about it.
It's interesting, the groups you mentioned, Jewish Voice for Peace, U.S. Campaign to End the Occupation, which are actually both run by Israeli Americans, they lobby Capitol Hill, or they believe in the same way. They go and visit their members of the legislative of Congress, acting as if giving them the facts about what Israel's doing to the Palestinians, they're not aware of, that simply going to them, a member of Congress, and arguing, presenting a position that they want to convince the member of Congress to vote on, and believing that their arguments are going to change a congressperson's position, is naivety at its best. This is almost like Alice in Wonderland, because they fail to recognize or admit that Congress is Israeli occupied territory.
That's the essential problem. My organization, Council for the National Interest, we decided a long time ago that it was a waste of time to go over to Congress. I mean, there are a couple of congressmen who will kind of listen to you, but they're not going to jeopardize their careers by doing anything beyond that. And the rest of them just don't care. They know where the money is. They know where the power is, and it ain't coming from us.
And they also know that if they took a position, let's say supporting the Palestinians or critical of Israel, that they would not have any organizations at their back. We've had a number of members of the Black Caucus over the years, the last one being Cynthia McKinney, who did stand up and criticize Israel. And each and every one of them were targeted by AIPAC and literally were forced out of Congress, and they had nobody defending them. And so it's a lose-lose proposition. Unless you have some kind of family income waiting for you, if you take a position critical of Israel, you're going to find yourself on the outs. And when you get out of Congress, unless you have a skill, I remember my former lawyer, Pete McCloskey, who's probably a mutual friend, Pete McCloskey was a Republican member of Congress, opposed the war in Vietnam. He spoke out on the floor against Israel and criticized and supported the Palestinians. And he found when he got out of office that a number of people he had helped in the legal business didn't want to have anything to do with him because they didn't want to be tainted and lose their business by having any connection to him. This is how it really works. And I remember in 1989, Morton Kodraki, writing in the very pro-Israel New Republic, said, A pro-Israel member of Congress told him it's not out of affection for Israel that Israel gets $3 billion a year, and there's no debate in Congress on this. It says you don't want to wake up the next morning with an opponent having a $500,000 war chest to run against you.
Yeah, absolutely. That's happened to Paul Findlay and McCloskey, as I said before, Fulbright, Chuck Percy, and the list goes on. People like Abe Foxman at the ADL basically making the argument that people who are critics like me and you who link Jews and money and the process that goes on to defend Israel and support Israel are committing some kind of blood libel. Well, I mean, is it a blood libel to say what's right in front of your face and what's going on? That's the kind of weapons that they use.
And it works. It doesn't work as much as it used to, but it works certainly to the degree that people are literally afraid to speak out. Churches which would take positions criticizing Israel's occupation and calling for boycotting those companies that do business in the West Bank, like Motorola, like Hewlett-Packard, like Caterpillar with their bulldozers that are used to destroy houses, even they are pressured. When they meet, they have pro-Israel lobbyists coming in telling them what they should be doing. It's an extraordinary thing, and it really does not fully get discussed anywhere where the ordinary citizen can hear it. I mean, this program is unique for that.
I mean, I'm not saying that the American public will always do the right thing, but the fact is, when they're completely ignorant on what is actually going on in the Middle East, and this extends to it extends beyond Israel in terms of what's going on in Syria right now, vis-a-vis the Russians and so on and so forth. We have people who are experts at manipulating the narrative, and it applies to Israel, applies to other issues. Very often, Israel is linked to some of these issues, as it is in Syria. And the fact is, the public doesn't have a clue what's going on. And we're inching, while this is going on, we're inching closer and closer to what could become a nuclear war. And people should be real afraid of this, and they should be demanding that Clinton and Trump address these issues, but it's not going to happen.
My guest is Phil Giraldi, and we are talking about Israel's gift by President Obama of $38 billion of your tax money, American tax money, to Israel over the next decade and implications of that. Certainly, when Obama appointed Hillary Clinton as a Secretary of State, and she immediately brought in the Robert Kagan, a co-founder of the Project for New American Century, who had been advising John McCain as her advisor, and hired Valerie Newland, Kagan's wife, who had been a top aide to Dick Cheney as a press spokesperson. That went totally unnoticed by the U.S. media. And, of course, we had Victoria Nuland openly bragging about helping to orchestrate the coup to overthrow the elected government of Ukraine. We don't even hear about that coup anymore. The story now begins with the annexation of Crimea.
Yeah, that's right. That's a perfect example of how the narrative has shifted. And Hillary Clinton has always, in terms of her foreign policy, has always been much closer to the neocons than she has been to traditional Democratic suspicion of involvement in these overseas activities. She did indeed bring them in. And Kagan, of course, even worked his way into the White House with sit-downs with President Obama to do readings from his book. We have a situation where neoconservative foreign policy, even though it is poorly understood by the public and is hostile to actual American interests in much of the world, is basically dominant in both political parties.
And it's also interesting that in all the debates between her and Sanders, these issues did not come up, which seemed to be mutually agreed by everybody, those doing the questioning and those doing the answering. But Clinton has been going around to various think tanks like her friend Haim Saban's Forum or American Enterprise Institute, and so on, and giving the neocon line. And Kagan even says she's a neocon, although she won't, they won't be called that. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. The Hillary has been assiduously courting the neocons, and I think whatever her actual motives are, we don't know, of course. But the fact is that it's a guarantee of a lot of good publicity coming from a lot of people who are self-styled foreign policy and national security experts, and it impresses some people. And even that CIA rogue Michael Morell writing a completely nonsensical piece about Russia and about what Hillary would do to Russia. It impresses some people, and they get a pass on it.
Well, I'm going to shift back to the argument that people I hear from people ostensibly on our side on the left say the reason Israel is supported is because it is an asset for the United States. Although it's difficult to find anybody with any degree of knowledge or intelligence that says that, but they point out one of the things you point out here that the argument that Israel provides these useful defense technologies for the United States. They're useful for Israel, but not for the United States. Perhaps you could talk about that area.
Yeah, sure. This has been another thing. Israel has, over the past few years, received every year, in addition to the 3.1 or 3.3, depending on how you count it, $1 billion that it gets directly from the U.S. Treasury, it's gotten additional sums from our defense bill. And in our defense bill, we've given Israel hundreds of millions of dollars to develop these technologies. Now, one of these technologies is what they call the Iron Dome system. And the Iron Dome system is intended to stop incoming missiles. And in particular, in this case, we're talking about the bottle rockets and other improvised weapons that the Palestinians in Gaza have on occasion been firing into Israel. So we, the U.S. taxpayers, have been ponying up hundreds of millions of dollars to develop these systems, which Israel then in turn is marketing to countries like India and South Korea. And the issue here is that the United States makes similar system. The Patriot missile system is essentially a similar type of weapon. So Israel is directly competing with us, and we're providing the money. And the other thing is this tunnel detection technologies, which we again have footed the bill of hundreds of millions of dollars for Israel to develop the technology. It's underground, basically underground radar, and they're going to seal off Gaza with this radar, so the Palestinians will be unable to dig a tunnel underneath. Now, this technology has a limited application for Israelis, and there may be other parts of the world where it's also marketable, but the fact is it's not something the United States needs. It's a technology that really is of no use to us. So it's, again, we're paying the bill for things that in some cases directly compete with us, and in other cases are completely useless.
You know, one of the lines I quoted in my introduction today is the statement, which is nothing truer: groveling to Israel is in the American political DNA.
Yeah.
And that it's extraordinary that we people speak about being independent and strong and free and independent country, but in a sense, there was an Indian American who wrote an article not long ago from in India, comparing the relationship between Israel and the United States to that between Britain and India during the colonial times, seeing
right.
that, in fact, by the way he described it, the U.S. is a colonial possession of India. It takes its resources and provides nothing. And as politicians answer to that, the idea of Netanyahu coming here and and having members of Congress virtually line up to kiss his ring, or that they go over there every other year during their recess, instead of spending time in their home districts, they go over there and they stand. And this is Democrat and Republican. This is the only bipartisan issue that I'm aware of. For years, it's been a bipartisan issue, whether it was Hunt and Jesse Helms and Barbara Boxer. You know, it doesn't matter who, what position you, whether you're a liberal Democrat or right wing Republican, it wouldn't really matter on this particular issue. They lock arms, and this has to be explained in some other way than Israel being a strategic asset. I mean, we saw people opposing apartheid in South Africa, but they were, including the Black Caucus, but they were too scared and too intimidated to say a word about when Israel was sending arms to South Africa. The same thing with the Contras in Nicaragua or Guatemala. And the idea that these Democrats didn't seriously oppose human rights violations in Guatemala, Nicaragua, El Salvador, because they were silent when Israel was providing the weapons, defies reality. And there's another reason for it.
Yeah, clearly the reason is what we were discussing. I mean, there's a multiplicity of reasons why congressmen defer to Israel, and but the one thing that you people like you and myself should be saying to our audience is that these reasons are false. That essentially the United States gets absolutely nothing out of the relationship with Israel except grief. We have to defend Israel and the UN. We have to give them now $3.8 billion a year to keep them from completely disrupting our political system by sending Netanyahu over here to address Congress. It's like, you know, always being threatened by Israel that unless we do something that Israel perceives to be in its interest, they're going to get mad at us. And if they get mad at us, there will be consequences. This is the analogy of British India. I read that article, as a matter of fact, and he was basically saying that a small number of Englishmen ran a country of 400 million Indians, and it's somewhat similar to how the Israelis, through their surrogates here in the United States, run the U.S. And there's a lot of truth to it. There's tongue-in-cheek, but a lot of truth.
I should say that going back to what I mentioned earlier, that a bill in the State Assembly and State Senate that passed 34-1 in the Senate and 60-0 with 20 abstentions in the Assembly, that would essentially make boycotting and calling for divestment in Israel, boycotting Israel against the law in California, was just signed into law by Governor Brown. There was a half-hearted campaign to get Brown to veto this law and not sign it, but this is the same kind of political naivete demonstrated by those who were calling the members of the Assembly and trying to present arguments against passing a legislation against boycott, divestment, and sanctions, when in fact the only thing that would probably work is the kind of confrontations we saw in the 60s when politicians could get embarrassed. If most Americans knew what their members of Congress were saying about Israel and they're pledging their allegiance to Israel, they would be a little irritated. And that the survey that was run by Grant Smith of IRMIP, Institute for Research Middle East Policy, who you've heard on these airwaves, showed that 81% of Americans do not support aid to Israel. And interesting thing, in all the polls that they take about Israel and Palestine, the only question they ask, well, who do you support more, the Israelis or the Palestinians? And it's obviously, given the input that they get from the state-controlled media, or from the, not state-controlled media, by the Zionist-controlled media or intimidated media, they're going to answer they support Israel more. But that isn't the question that's really important, is when there have been polls taken, how do Americans view other countries around the world? Israel's way down on the list behind all the European countries, for example.
Yeah, it's a shaping of the narrative, and you shape the narrative as you and I well know. I mean, when you're doing an opinion poll, the question is what dictates the answer, And as you're absolutely right, when they say they created a question which essentially suggests a yes or no answer, and naturally, because the American public is saturated with positive news about Israel and bad news about Arabs in general, it's the reflex reaction is going to be, yeah, I prefer Israel. And but then if you get down to it and you get down to actual issues, and the question I always wanted to see on one of these polls was, you know, do you believe it's in America's interest to support Israel against its neighbors? That's never asked. It's because, it, of course, it's not in the U.S. interest. There's no way it's in the U.S. interest, even with the propaganda narrative that Israel is a great ally and our and the sole democracy in the Middle East, which, of course, is nonsense.
Well, speaking of all that, today we heard of the passing of one of Israel's founding fathers, Shimon Peres, and far be it from me to, but they say, don't say ill of the past, but there's a very different narrative when it comes not only to the Palestinians, but Peres was the one who developed Israel's nuclear program, weapons program, which we're not allowed to speak about, and was one of those behind the first terrorist act committed against the United States back in 1953 in Egypt, when an Israeli group of Israeli saboteurs, Egyptian Jews, planted bombs, started fires in the U.S. and British film libraries, and one was caught with explosive in his pocket. It became called the Lavon Affair, and something wasn't talked about for years, but Peres was one of the people behind that. But we won't hear about that. Perhaps your thoughts on Peres.
Yeah, well, he's been described as a man of peace, but of course the peace he envisioned was kind of a Helot relationship, Spartans and Helots, with the Palestinians. He wanted to work out some accommodation where the Israeli Jews would be able to dominate the Palestinians. So the peace label is a bit misleading. He also was when he was prime minister, he was the one who started the settlements shortly after the 1967 war. He was the one who directed the first settlements on the West Bank. So he got that going. And, of course, you're quite correct. He was one of the ones who was most instrumental in terms of developing or getting the materials and the kinds of connections, establishing the kinds of connections that led to the development of the U.S., of the Israeli nuclear weapon arsenal, which, of course, was completely opposed by John F. Kennedy and others at the time. So, he was kind of a mixed bag, definitely an opportunist. Judging from the New York Times today and Washington Post, the biography, of course, is being rewritten for him.
Well, I guess from the standpoint, if you're a supporter of Israel, you have to say he's one of his great heroes, but he was one of his founding fathers, and he saw building the state of Palestine. I guess he was born in Poland as well, was really something that needed to be done, and it didn't matter, like for him and others, they wouldn't let anything stand in their way. We'll hear no criticism at all about him, and this is the way. This is just another example of a world figure passing, but when it comes to someone like Shimon Peres or Yitzhak Rabin, Yitzhak Rabin was the one who actually ordered the breaking of hands of young Palestinian boys who were throwing stones during the First Intifada. And and after Oslo, he continued building settlements in the occupied territories, and the Americans weren't aware of that, which eventually created the Second Intifada. And the Oslo Agreement, I remember listening to Shlomo Gazit, a former head of Israeli intelligence, speaking at a temple in San Francisco to a hostile Jewish audience, which was against the Oslo Agreement, and he said, to somebody who compared it with the Munich Pact with the Nazis in 38, he said to this very enraged person standing in an aisle I don't like to make comparisons, but if it's Munich, we're the Germans and the Palestinians are the Czechs. And that was the reality of Oslo. Israel was given by Yasser Arafat legitimacy in a major part of the West Bank, which ordinarily would be against international law because you can't give away land to an occupier. But in this case, like recognizing Abbas after years of being out of his term having run out, Abbas is still considered the president of Palestine by U.S. and the international community when his term of office and the extension ran out years ago. When it comes to Israel-Palestine, it's just the laws of nature are halted.
Yeah, we're Israel-Palestine is in a parallel universe, unfortunately. I mean, it also, as you and I have been discussing, I mean, it's just a product of ignorance and deliberate narrative shifting, unfortunately, that is why the American public is as unable to cope with the real issues as it is.
Well, we are heading for a new election. One last time for one last comment. Do you think who is elected in November is going to make any difference in this issue?
No, I think on this issue they're both going to be completely in Israel's pocket. I mean, my vote will probably depend on whether I continue to believe that that Trump would be willing to talk with the Russians rather than treating them as enemies. To me, that's a critical international issue, and it would be the single issue that I would vote on.
Well, Phil Giraldi, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today on a radio program you're not likely to hear on any other radio station, unfortunately, in this country. And we'll look forward to
thank
doing
you,
it
Jeff.
Again. Take care. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.